It's the inaugural record release from Discography. Metal Machine Muzak is a slanted tribute to Lou Reed's divisive 1975 double LP Metal Machine Music. Lester Bangs called it the greatest album ever made, but no matter how it hits you, it's always been the ultimate music freak secret handshake. My ambient reimagining features four 16-minute, one-second tracks, just like the original, and each one was created by a top-shelf indie rock visionary, Lou Barlow from Dinosaur Jr. and Sebado, Corey Hansen from Wand, W. Cullen Hart from the Olivia Tremor Control, and Mark Robinson from Unrest. That's right, not a slouch in the bunch, unlike 99% of the compilations you've ever begrudgingly purchased for the one and only band on it you just had to hear. Metal Machine Muzak will not be available on streaming. The digital version is finally available for purchase, and the vinyl will be shipped this summer. Pre-orders for the LPs are available now, but they're going fast. They're being produced in a very limited edition run of 300 numbered 180-gram metallic silver double LP gatefold copies, only 100 of which can be ordered online. These copies will be numbered from 1 to 100, and they're first come, first served. To order either the digital or the vinyl, just head over to patreon.com/discography/shop. Again, that's patreon.com/discography/shop. Don't miss out on Metal Machine Muzak, the ambient experience designed to make Brian Eno run screaming.
Osiris.
We liked making this album a little bit more absurd, you know, and that has to do with like where you feel like you're coming from musically first, and then you try to put words that fit that.
Yeah, they reflect those feelings.
Welcome to Discography, the music obsessives podcast that gives freaks like you and me the chance to connect with a brotherhood obsessed with rating the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever mattered. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and with 3 to 4 episodes each week, you're going to gain a comprehensive knowledge of an act's history and output in the time it takes to listen to one album. Each new guest swings a hard left into an area you either had no idea you needed to know about or know all about and can't believe you're not alone out there. I am thrilled to announce that we have partnered with the podcast network Osiris Media, the leading storyteller in music. You can check out all their music podcasts at osirispod.com. And in this episode, we'll be turning our spray cans on the Beach Boys' Wild Honey. Along with our special guests, Michael and Brian Daddario of the Lemon Twigs. In this episode, we reveal, jammed in there like a Trojan horse right in the intro, a sneak attack rating of the Lemon Twigs' entire discography. How the myth of the unreleased Smile LP made the lo-fi Beach Boys era an even more bemusing mind scrambler of a prospect for the record-buying public to accept. And the Twigs' prowess in getting me to a place of love and acceptance with all the latter-day Beach Boys records, including the Mound of Feces, also called Summer in Paradise. I'm going to take this opportunity now to give a shout out to brand new Patreon member Tyler Davis, an 18-year-old young man with great taste and a soft spot for the mamas and the papas who literally canceled his cable TV and subscribed to Discography at the Brigadier General tier, which is $40 a month. Trust me, if he can find a way, so can you. Tyler, I love you, and you are seriously my hero. Coming up on Discography, we've got Michael Imperioli rating his favorite band, The Smiths, an interview with Tom Bailey from the Thompson Twins, Robert Schneider rating the Strawberry Alarm Clock, and the three surviving Dedrick siblings rating everything they ever released as one of the greatest bands of all time, bar none, The Free Design. So don't miss out. Open up your listening app right now and subscribe. And away we go then. I've been following you guys from the beginning. I used to be close friends with Simon White and Go Hollywood before it came out. He threw on track 1 for me and I was an immediate fan.
Huh? What is that? Smile.
I got that in 1990. They're my favorite band. So I'm talking with basically my favorite band on the planet now, talking about my favorite band. Probably the most interesting era of the band is post-Smile.
And talking about our favorite band, too.
I know it's yours. Man, the fucking new record is so good. And I was initially going to ask you if you wanted to do Rundgren, but Rado did Rundgren on my show.
Yes, I remember that, yeah.
Have you heard it?
Yeah, we were with Rado before he did it.
Oh, really?
Like the day before.
I don't know what I'm going to say about those later albums.
Well, he didn't stick around.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, he refused, and I kept being a pest about it. But then we just, post-1982, we did everything, and there's so much. You know, the rap stuff. By the way, have you guys heard about Metal Machine Muzak?
Muzak?
Yeah. I'm putting together a tribute album called Metal Machine Muzak, and each side is a different artist doing an ambient reimagining of Metal Machine music. And it's Lou Barlow, Will Hart from Olivia Tremor Control, Mark Robinson from Unrest, and Corey Hansen from Wand.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah.
That's cool.
I'll get you guys a copy of it.
Cool, that'd be great.
And away we go then! In their relatively brief career, our two guests have accumulated a crazily considered discography, which astoundingly gets literally better and better with each of their releases, Simian rock opera notwithstanding. Consider this introduction, then, as my audition to do a larger, more intricate and inward-looking show covering the first decade of the Lemon Twigs' growth. There's the 100-copy 2015 cassette-only, charmingly meandering psych debut What We Know, which I'll give 3 stars, recorded when you were 16 and 14 years old, 2016's Rundgren Redux Carnival Oompa indie art pop debut Go Hollywood, which I'll give 4.25 stars, 2017's home recorded cupboard clearing EP Brothers of Destruction, essentially a Jonathan Rado-less Go Hollywood part deux, thus an equal 4.25 stars. Then comes 2018's precociously kick-ass sophomore slump face plant Go to School, which sure has detractions, but lack of ambition ain't one of them, and I've discovered to my progressive pleasure that it's unquestionably a grower, so I'll give it 3.75 stars. Then comes what to me is unquestionably your transitional fulcrum point album, the reach for the rafters, operatic, Lou Reed meets Nilsson biker prog pop of 2020's Songs for the General Public, 5 fucking stars. Then, like a bomb, along came 2023's Beach Boys Upper Downer Dichotomy Earworm Masterpiece, Everything Harmony, 5 stars. And I'd be utterly remiss to not mention that they're largely responsible for objectively the greatest Todd Rundgren song in decades, entitled I'm Leaving, replete with wonderfully wobbly Takes Two to Tango timekeeping, which you can find on Runt's 2022 Space Force LP. And then, of course, there's last week's hot off the presses, A Dream Is All We Know, an unsurprisingly 5-star, lean, mean, Baroque AM gold fighting machine. Just imagine the Raspberries transported back to 1963 via DeLorean and aiming to wow just like Marty McFly's jaw-dropping guitar pyrotechnics. This is a perfect record that, if there's any hope left in the universe, we'll be troubling the charts in a major fucking way. Lads and ladies, taking solace in the notion that rampant conceptual chaos can and should be corralled into a reined-in series of tricky time-signatured oohs and ahs, because how else are you gonna flip those rusty old switches lodged deep within our jaded emotional fuse boxes? Coming at you for nigh on 9 years with some sick skill from Hicksville, it's Brian and Michael Daddario, a.k.a. the Lemon Twigs.
Whoa, thank you. Thunderous applause from these guys.
Now, how did I do on the ratings? Do you guys think that I hit it on the head?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
I would have scored some shit probably a little lower, but the last 3 were right on the nose.
This has been a big buildup. we've been going back and forth on what are we going to do. And I kept telling Ailey, listen, if we had 5 minutes on the phone, we could take care of this in an instant. You know, I even threw that in as a possibility to redo Rundgren. You know, there were so many possible directions we could have gone. I still would love to do you guys because I think you guys are so well versed in music history. I can always tell if a band knows about music, has studied music, has, you know, ingested liner notes, album covers, backs of covers, because you guys, it feels like you're at 30,000 feet watching yourselves doing this. And it's almost like you have this thing, not necessarily planned out, but you have a sense of what makes an interesting band arc.
I think we know what makes sense as a next step, even if it seems outrageous to other people. We kind of can see what's a natural development that will satisfy us and that will hopefully appeal to crowd goers.
I thought about taking the setup of the Beach Boys and just veering it into just asking you questions about the Beach Boys that really portended to you guys. Mm-hmm. Because to me, they have one of the most interesting arcs, if not the most interesting arc ever.
Yeah, to us too, you know?
Yes.
It's like, because there's always a creative consistency and there's always a certain quality to what they do. Because you can't even get the voices down in the way that everybody has their own part without a certain degree of craft. You can't just write off any Beach Boy album, really, you know? I mean, people do, but I don't think you really can. Though I've never heard Summer in Paradise.
I was just going to bring it up.
I've never heard that. I've heard, I'm sure, tracks from it. But what is the album with, Cruisin'? I've heard parts of that. And I've heard songs from that I thought were really good, you know. There's a Brian Wilson song on there. Is Let's Go to Heaven in my car on that?
In My Car, yes.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, you know, in the way that his first solo album is just, like, amazing, you know.
Yeah.
He has so many Pet Sounds, Love Yous, you know, fully creative albums.
When you guys came at me with the Beach Boys, I got really nervous. Because when there's a major band with a huge amount of output, it's the kind of thing where it would hijack Discog Graffiti, because you've heard the show. We go into things in depth. It's not a surface level thing. So it would basically take over the show for a while. So I've never really gone into a phase of a band. But this particular phase that you guys chose is a really interesting one. Just in terms of how it dovetails with your new record, I find it really interesting in the streamlining of your sound, because I know you guys are bursting at the seams with ideas, tons of ideas. And probably the hardest thing for the two of you to do, I'm guessing, is to corral that stuff and keep it hemmed in and just stick with an idea. But, you know, the idea of choosing the runtime of 34 minutes and going back even farther for inspiration, I'm hearing Peter and Gordon, Chad and Jeremy. I'm hearing stuff in here that's very winsome and almost like the next step is going to be the Andrews Sisters or something. Like, just keep going back and back and back.
Yeah.
Whereas the last one, I would say more early 70s. This is more early to mid 60s, it sounds to me.
Yeah. Well, I think the main thing with us is that we kind of look at it as almost a Beach Boys philosophy, in that we can take a song that's 5 years old or a recording that's 5 years old, and if it's well recorded and well done and our vocalizations aren't somewhere way off into some rabbit hole that we're not in. Again, what I'm talking about is like with the album Songs for General Public, where I'm singing in a really operatic style. Something like that would not work on this new record.
Right.
But there are two songs off the new record that are from 2017. And to us, that's kind of a Beach Boys type thing to do, to take a song that's like that and just remix it or add a few vocals and stuff like that. And what I was going to say about the Beach Boys before is that there's a certain level of interest I have in every single Beach Boy recording, especially ones that involve any one of the Wilson brothers, because there's a certain level of craftsmanship that goes into every recording that is interesting on a production level, even if you're not too interested in the song. A lot of the songs too, there's a certain level of craftsmanship that's innate in the songwriting. It makes it so that there's a crumb of something, even on their worst day, you know? So I don't know. I relate that to us in that we kind of function in a compilatory style when it comes to making a record. We take songs sometimes from different places or from different periods, and we put them together because we don't want to will ourselves to do something in the same style. So we kind of curate ourselves, you know?
So yeah. Then what was the gateway in or the keyhole into this record? What was the holdover from 2017?
The two songs that were held over were the song If You and I Are Not Wise and I Should Have Known from the Start. And then the song Ember Days was a song that was supposed to go on Everything Harmony, which I think if you know the records, you could kind of hear that. But the fact was with the last record, it was so many down ballads with nylon string guitar, it just felt like another one would be a detriment to the song and to the record. And we really believed in both of the song and the record. So we thought it would actually be more elevated in the context of a more upbeat record to be the ballad or one of the two or three ballads, you know?
I don't know what it is with record companies being such boneheads when there's so obviously a breakthrough record happening. I mean, when I was reading about Everything Harmony being a sort of up for grabs thing, you know, then going to Capture Tracks, I was thinking about Yankee Hotel Foxtrot because it's like there's no A&R people anymore that can recognize anything.
Well, the person that works at Capture Tracks was the person who signed us to 4AD.
And so we love her.
She's great. She's great. And she left 4AD at a certain point and moved to Omnian or whatever. And so it made sense us going to her. And also, you know, she was interested the whole time, you know. But, we wanted to weigh our options at that time. And we did get a lot of people saying, we're not interested, you know. Or one of the things we got was like, if you guys considered working with a mixing engineer to make it more modern or something like that, or to make it like something that could compete, you know, I would think like something that was more compressed and like
maybe more bass and more punch.
Everything Harmony was like kind of the record and collection of songs that we were sending to people, you know. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't really matter though, you know. For us, it's like going to like their office or whatever, Capture Tracks. And the fact that like it's sort of a smaller office, it kind of makes more sense for us.
You know? We like our label. It's not to say we don't like our label, but it's an interesting thing that when we were first trying to shop around the record, we've been around for a while and we couldn't get to much interest. I think we are kind of proud of that in a sense because the music spoke for itself and it proved us right to an extent. I'm kind of proud of that. What'd you say, Brian?
Yeah, no, never mind.
What'd you say?
I was just saying, not proving them wrong, prove us right. You know, that's slightly lighter language.
Well, that's the truth. It's not about proving them wrong. It's more about when you get that kind of response, you feel like, well, dejected, especially when you feel like, well, okay, I think I have an audience. So it's, you know, that the record is going to sell somewhat. It's not like a risk to sign us. You know, they must just really not like the music.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, first of all, I know you were going through a lot of heavy stuff at the time. The music is a very apt and very moving reflection of everything that was happening in your life from what I've read. Also, I know that it was more of a union of your, and I know we're spending some time away from the Beach Boys here, but there's one more point I want to make is that you guys were kind of celebrating coming together with your vision. But there's a point I want to make about Songs for the General Public, which is that I know that you were at odds in your vision with that record. And I got to say, just from an outsider fan, a listener's point of view, is that I don't think that that's a detriment to your music. There's a very interesting thing that happened with that record that I think if you were on the same page, wouldn't be there. So, so not to dismiss that record, I don't think a course correction was necessarily needed from that record. Uh-huh. It's an incredible record. That was the first one where I thought you guys were functioning on like a whole different level, really a whole different level. Yeah.
I appreciate that a lot.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Dave Gebro. I threw my career as a licensed hearing instrument specialist in the trash, sold my house, and moved to the East Coast with my wife and 4-year-old son in order to focus on making the ultimate podcast for music obsessives thrive. Now I need your help. Although Discograffiti is rated in the top 2% of all podcasts globally, the economics of this thing are tricky. Becoming a member of Discograffiti's Patreon gives you access to over 100 more exclusive episodes. episodes, and moving forward now every Sunday for only $5 a month as a private first class, you get our new weekly show by and for Discography's Patreon family, the Discography Soldiers of Sound podcast. If all you want to do is show some love, there's now finally a $1 tier. Don't miss out. Become a recruit and get your personalized backstage pass for $1. And for the cheapskates, homeless people, and all the bums sponging off mom and dad, don't care, just join. It's now completely free to join as a basic member. That's it, back to the show. Anyway, so for any bonehead out there who doesn't know about Smile, just to get this out of the way, because it's important to know what Smile is to understand what Wild Honey and Friends are. So Brian Wilson and the Beatles were in a neck-and-neck production race. You know, one album begat another. If there was no Rubber Soul, there'd be no Pet Sounds. You know, it kept bouncing back and forth like that. And then Smile, as far as I'm concerned, you know, the what-ifs, the quantum mechanics behind the musical questions, what would have changed if Smile had come out, to me are endless. And it's part of the greatness of the record is that the speculation behind what could have happened if this thing was released at that time ranges anywhere from nothing at all to it would have changed the course of music history. I veer toward the latter, but anything is possible. And it took forever. Anyone who is taken with Smile and the history of Smile, as I have been, I mean, when I was 18 years old, I would, you know, I have Dominic Priori's book, and I remember tripping on acid as an 18-year-old, looking at certain pictures in there and just weeping. The intensity, the depth of feeling, the emotion behind what went in there, the conceptual heft. But then along with the head comes so much heart, it's almost impossible to convey it in any way that makes sense whatsoever, kind of like describing an acid trip. And then he, right at the end, gave up. I mean, a lot of people think that Smile was left incomplete. It's kind of finished, but he just didn't want to mix it down and release it. But he kind of had all the pieces together. That's one of the things that's so mind-blowing about this. And yeah. Then my very first question to you guys is Smiley Smile, which came out and Carl Wilson famously described as a bunt instead of a grand slam, which was thrown down in, you know, a few weeks. Why didn't you want to throw that into what really is like a trilogy of Beach Boys lo-fi records?
I actually don't know. I think because Wild Honey, we probably have listened to more, you know? I mean, I think Smiley Smile is an incredible record. I guess it's just, you know, I was talking to Michael about it because I listened a lot to Laid in Hawaii. Yeah. And it's such a defined version of the Beach Boys in terms of arrangement. It fits so well with Smiley Smile and fits so well with Wild Honey. And that's like a sound of theirs that is totally unique to them and unique to that time, that span of those three albums, really those two albums, because Friends has a little bit more of a studio feel. And I was thinking about the fact that Good Vibrations and Heroes and Villains, they do versions, like Smiley Smile-esque versions of those songs that are so interesting. And I was saying it would be interesting if Smiley Smile had, it kind of has sort of a disjointed feel with those big productions at the top of both sides, whereas the rest of the album is very stripped back. And that kind of makes it feel a bit less like a
vision for record,
like an artistic statement, even though it obviously is, you know. I mean, it's almost like that album is just working with the Beach Boys on the instrumentation and the vocals is like the most stress-free way for Brian Wilson to be incredibly creative with arrangement. I mean, there's almost as much arrangement that goes on that album. Well, maybe not.
No.
I think,
but
yes.
It's clever arrangement.
Yeah. When you think about the stress of an 11-piece group or more in the studio and telling them all what to do, and then you think of what it must have been like for him to record Smiley Smile, it's like night and day. I mean, it's almost more of an artistic process than being in a production race, you know?
I don't think almost more. I think it's more, because think of the restraint that had to have come from having the wrecking crew at your beck and call 24 hours a day to, you know, how Vegetables starts with just the single bass note and then the pouring of the water. I mean, to go from all of that to funnel it down to just that is a massive artistic statement. And it probably started the entire bedroom pop movement, is that record.
Yeah. But I don't, there's not any real reason why. I do think, though, when we're working, we tend to think of Wild Honey arrangements more than Smiley Smile arrangements, because it's really about the bare essentials, obviously, but there is a fullness to the arrangements on Wild Honey.
Yeah.
And also the way that that is an interpretation of soul music. If you don't have like a particularly like funky drummer, you know, the best thing to do is like imply this sort of groove by just leaving out everything other than the upbeat, a great mark of that album.
Yeah. You know, they've all commented on that they didn't feel like a band anymore, because they would go out on tour, come back, lay down their vocals on tracks that had already been laid, and that was it. So they didn't really feel like a band. And this was them sort of becoming a band again. And the quote I always think about when I think about Wild Honey is Carl Wilson in 1976 said, "Wild Honey was very simply music to cool out by." Brian had done a bunch of, you know, I don't think he did a lot of acid, but he was just fried from everything and just needed to just chill. And this was getting back to Boogie Woogie and getting together as family. I mean, Smiley Smile was kicked off by, I think they bought like $5,000 worth of hash. It was a hash record, just them sitting around smoking hash. Wild Honey, I'm guessing some of that was left over because it was, you know, only a couple months after that. All right, so Wild Honey, it came out in December 1967. What it doesn't really get a lot of credit for, which is super interesting to me, is that whole thing of, you know, let's strip it back and, you know, get back to the country. The movement post-psychedelia, John Wesley Harding, the White Album, Beggar's Banquet, this came first. It actually beat John Wesley Harding by 9 days as far as hitting the shops. So the Beach Boys, and they still get no credit for that. Although maybe it sits, maybe not in the same exact company, it touches on the same kind of ideas.
Yeah.
Or the intentions behind the music.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, and I mean, I feel like this is some of the best collaboration between Brian and Mike as far as, you know, music and lyrics, because it's kind of down to earth, you know. I mean, Let the Wind Blow is one of my favorite Beach Boys lyrics. I don't know, I guess that's actually kind of interesting. I never thought about it before, though. Like, I'm sure some of the lyrical ideas were Brian's, actually, but I know Mike's credited for the lyrics, but they're just very direct, simple, pretty images, you know, and country air is kind of the same thing.
He hadn't actually been the lyric writer since Summer Days and Summer Nights. It was Tony Asher after that, then Van Dyke Parks. So Mike had been kicked to the curb since 1965.
Yeah. But I also, you know, I love Mike's lyrics, like Big Sur, you know. I mean, he's really good at those like nature lyrics, you know. And it also fits into his idea of like what the Beach Boys are about, you know?
Smiley Smile and Wild Honey are pretty dry records, which is not typical of the Beach Boys up to that point.
Not at all. I mean, typically it's that cavernous sound. It's
yeah, the echo chamber reverb.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's like the arrangements are very, really kind of simple, but the bass, it's like kind of all in the composition of the song, you know? Bass notes are being doubled, you know, with the left hand. And it's like the way Brian wrote songs, you know, all of the songs kind of came with these great bass lines
built in. Yeah.
Yeah, built in.
I guess it's like they strip everything back on Wild Honey and then they sort of start to add things back with Friends and 2020 and Sunflower. The arrangement is and using other musicians and stuff is creeping back in, and the reverb is creeping back in as well.
Right.
Though not to be ever as reverberated as it was once before in the past, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting, and I hadn't thought about this until right now, is that Wild Honey is to the 60s what Love You is to the 70s. It's stripping the process of songwriting back to its basics, getting, you know, much more in touch with just the nuts and bolts of writing a song, and sometimes in such a way that is almost hysterically mundane.
Throwing that bass drum into a river.
So there's only five tracks on Wild Honey that have session musicians. And even then, they're kind of sparingly deployed. Wild Honey, right. Aren't You Glad, I Was Made to Love Her, Darlin', and Here Comes the Night. A lot of the weirdness of Smile and Smiley Smile, not even a lot of the weirdness, all of the weirdness is basically gone. You know, at the time when it came out, the critics, unsurprisingly, saw it as a very inconsequential work. You know, everything that was coming out around that time was marked by a gargantuan heaviosity. So, you know, something like this, especially the runtime, is 23 minutes, 54 seconds.
I was looking at the Beach Boys runtimes, and all of the early records were around that runtime, like Surfin' USA and Surfer Girl. So, I mean, I guess he really was thinking about, he was just in a recording mode that he kind of was in early on, I guess, of using the band, using session musicians sparingly, keeping the songs very short. I mean, it's interesting, like on the Sunshine Tomorrow box set, they have a version of I Was Made to Love Her with the whole middle section, the whole bridge that they cut out. And they have like the version with the bridge. And I guess it's an a cappella bridge. Like they never recorded any backing to it. And I guess it was meant to be an a cappella bridge, but it works really well. Also on Friends, there's like a version of Wake the World that's longer. You know, you see that a lot on Sunflower, like a 3.5 minute version of This Whole World.
How about Meant for You? I had no idea that was a whole full song that was just faded out.
Yeah.
That was a stunner, because Meant for You, I was so used to that being this tiny little confection that it was shocking to hear all those lyrics.
Yeah.
In those other cases, like I almost feel like, I mean, I wouldn't change any Beach Boy album or whatever, but it's like you hear those longer versions and you feel like it could totally work, you know, and work just as well. But in the case of Meant for You, it's really cool, the long version, but it's definitely more poetic and beautiful as they put it on the record, I think.
Oh, hi. I got to tell you about the next tier. As a lieutenant, you get an ad-free, substantially elongated director's cut of every episode. And you'll be getting the shows a few days earlier than the general populace, which is designed to make you feel even more special than you already are. And now back to our expertly crafted program. So one thing that makes this whole era so much more complex is, you know, think of it contextually, for a good 5 years or so, from 67 to maybe 72, these guys are operating with these admittedly kind of confectionery albums. And it's an aesthetic that he uses that's very different, but it's under this cloud of Brian Wilson is a genius, Smile is the greatest album ever made, but it's just a myth. So there's this myth-like cloud. Capitol, through this entire era, has not given up on the idea that it's releasing Smile. It still thinks, and the Beach Boys still think, that it's coming. And so, you know, there are these droplets of Smile that appear on, I think, every record. Maybe it's almost every record. You have Mama Says, you have Our Prayer, you know, these droplets that come out, they intimate that, yeah, he is a genius, but hold on, in the meantime, we have this, or we have this. So, you know, there has to be, you know, Brian was no fool. It's almost like he's driving the bus intentionally deep into the wilderness. He knows that people are aware that he's some incredible genius, but yet he's releasing these 20-minute albums that are about seeing you in the nude and going to sleep and how to get to his house. So it's so much more fascinating knowing the context there.
Yeah, it's just that their productions are so, so intricate and beautiful. They would be so difficult for anybody to pull off. It's all such hard work to make any of these recordings. I wonder if it's as conscious of like a thing to set maybe his sights lower, quote unquote, than something as difficult to obtain as, you know, some of the stuff that's on Smile. How difficult that must have been to make.
In the context of Heroes and Villains coming out, I guess they said that that was a big blow to him. The fact that I think it only charted as high as like 25 or something, and it fell pretty soon. I mean, you could argue that there are songs on Smile that are more pop than Heroes and Villains, but Good Vibrations really was the one obvious pop song that was a part of that record. The rest of it was like beautiful, you know, almost classical music, you know? That's what Bruce Johnson said, at least. He said he thought it should have been on a classical label or something like that. But, I mean, he really is just trying to make Beach Boys music and pop music throughout that whole period and incorporating the rest of the group more. And it's interesting. I guess I wonder if he ever really felt like he was going to actually complete it. I bet he probably didn't really throughout that period.
Yeah, I get the sense that he didn't, or that he couldn't fathom, well, just the pain. You know, if something is that painful, then it's hard for the mind to look. It's like looking into the sun. You know, you could do it, but, you know, why would you want to? For the person doing it, it makes no sense. For the rest of the world, it makes all the sense imaginable.
I mean, that method of recording and editing is so complicated, you know?
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of decision making, you know, a lot of kind of, it's not obvious all the time what you should be doing, you know?
Well, that's Smiles Like a Jigsaw Puzzle, the feels, he would call them. You know, those sections were all feels, and you could mix and match them. That's why it makes such a great proprietary union with the listener, is that, you know, I mean, I was making almost unlistenable boombox mixes of Smile back in 1990, 1991, editing on completely rudimentary equipment, just trying to get a sense of what my ultimate Smile would be. And, you know, in a pre-Pro Tools world, you had to have kept in your mind in a very organized way how it was intended. And I think Brian, I think the way that he would explain it was that it was just too big, it got out of control. But I think he knew from beginning to end exactly how it was supposed to go. When you hear on the Smile sessions or any bootlegs, just any of the ramshackle sessions that happen, that guy is totally in control. He's not tripping his tits off. He knows exactly what he wants to hear. He knows who's flatting out there. You know, he knows when to cut, when it's done. Everything's in place.
The Smile stuff feels like total creativity in the moment of the session, you know? It's like taking a minute and a half of music and making that minute and a half as great as it can possibly be, and taking a theme that you've done 20 different ways and finding a way to make that theme relevant in the moment. But yeah. It would be insane to really have a full picture of how everything comes together. Because like they said, Heroes and Villains was cut many different ways. And I mean, all the music is so many different arrangements of the same piece of musical information.
Scenes. It's just scenes. They feel like scenes in a movie at my most lysurgically influenced phase of my life. They seemed like places. Each of them seemed like geographical spaces, and I could see it as a map, like Smile Land. Yeah, almost synesthetic in a certain sense, but you know, each song has such a different feel to it, but yet the union of all the pieces makes so much sense, but they're their own places with their own spaces. So let's drop the needle on this sucker. What's your favorite songs on Wild Honey?
So when you become a major, you'll be getting access to the ultimate director's cuts of all our sprawling super deep dive episodes. As far as I'm concerned, these supercuts have absolutely everything that was meant to be heard. Plus, you get yours before the lieutenants get theirs. But that ain't it. You also get all our other series, like Discography's Top 10, our buried treasure show, Rock Cousteau, our slag-off show, Queasy Listening, and exclusive limited series like The Private Press with Paul Major. And if you've got no financial worries to speak of, keep in mind that some of the higher Patreon tiers allow you to actually advertise on the show, choose the bands we cover, or even some of the guests we get. For the price of a cup of coffee a week, you can ensure my family's fed, build a music library that'll be the envy of your block, and connect to a thriving community of music maniacs all at the same time. Don't risk feeling badly about yourself by not giving. Patreon.com/discograffiti. Once again, that's patreon.com/discograffiti.
I think Let the Wind Blow my favorite. And Country Air. Country Air, the Mellotron is just so great. It's very sparse, but it feels like a full production to me.
Right.
The same with Let the Wind Blow, the vocal sound effects. And those are pieces of music that they can kind of trick you into thinking that there's more on it than there is.
Yeah.
I would say Wild Honey, maybe Let the Wind Blow too. honestly, I love Just Wants to See You. I just love the vocals. The whole record, you know, Wild Honey, the lead vocal is just incredible. And yeah, I feel the same about I'd Love Just Wants to See You. I think that's a great lead vocal too. I just love how dry everything is. You can hear so perfectly everybody's vocalizations and stuff. It's and everybody at the height of their powers in terms of their tonality and quality of their voice too.
And there's also, it's kind of sparse with the group vocals. There's a lot of just lead vocal with backgrounds on this. And yeah. If ever there's a question about the soulfulness of the Beach Boys, Carl's ripping version of I Was Made to Love Her puts that to rest immediately. It's such a great version. It would seem like a laughable notion that they could pull that off in the way that they do. It's so good. But my favorite from the very beginning has always been Aren't You Glad?
Oh, yeah.
I love that song.
Up there, too.
It's so good.
Yeah, great, Mike, vocal, horn arrangement. And yeah, when those horns come in, I don't know how many parts there are. I think there might just be two parts. In your mind, it's just like a whole section. Yeah, the kind of percussive vocal parts that they do, like in Here Comes the Night, it's like they're like effects, you know?
Yeah.
The night, Here Comes the Night.
Well, they work differently. They work in that more percussive way, I think, without the reverb.
It kind of reminds me of Won't You Come Out Tonight off MIU.
Totally.
Right, that's right.
Like they're operating in the same way. It's just they sound crazy. I mean, they sound crazy doing those kind of vocals.
Or like, fuck up the tit.
Oh, Rolling Up to Heaven.
Yeah.
The most dirty Beach Boys song.
What is that on?
That's a Caribou session bootleg from 1974. The same sessions that they recorded the basic track of first track on LA Light. What is it, Michael? All those people living together. Good Timing.
Oh, Good Timing. Yeah, I love that song.
Yeah.
You need good timing.
The Rolling Up to Heaven is kind of like, it's like Ding Dang, but it's got some dirty words in it.
Ding Dang is so great, if only for the fact that that had to be a collaboration between Brian and Roger McGuinn.
Yeah.
It's incredible that it took two geniuses to create that. How She Boogalooed It is a very important song in the history of the Beach Boys. That was the very first original Beach Boys song to not feature any contribution from Brian.
That's wild.
Yeah. And so that to me represents quite a lot of what happened with the band. You guys are actually, I don't know if it's both of you that feel this way or if it's just you, Brian, but you're very generous in your view of later Beach Boys records. To me, I wouldn't say I'm a hard stop after Love You, but that's when I start to cherry pick, like really start to cherry pick. Because I feel like one of the most interesting aspects of the band is that something that on its surface feels so uninteresting to me in a lot of ways hides this underbelly that is like the definition of creativity to me. To me, Smile and Pet Sounds, it doesn't get any better than that with any work of art in any medium whatsoever. And then, you know, you look at the 4th of July Beach Boys concerts and the Mike and Bruce contingent. I actually attended a show in 1990. I still had the gauze on my Smile tattoo. And I went there with my Dominic Priori Beach Boys book held out because there was no web at the time. So I just wanted to, if there was any Smile fans, I wanted to befriend them. I needed to. And I explained to my sister. And of course, at the time I was 18, it was easier to have a black and white sort of outlook on the world. But that Mike Love was evil incarnate. He was the Antichrist. So we went up front and my sister, who at the time was 15, gave him the finger. And Mike was in the middle of California Girls. And to a 15-year-old girl, he goes like this with his pinky and then points to her. So, you know, from the beginning, I've sort of been, I don't know, brainwashed into thinking that things were very simple in the Beach Boys camp. It's that Brian Wilson equals unfettered creativity and genius, and Mike Love represents, you know, Satan.
Yeah.
As I've gotten older, I realize that it can't be that simple. But you guys, to say that Summer in Paradise is not without its redeeming qualities is an interesting viewpoint that I could probably talk about for 10 hours. That's a fan.
Summer in Paradise, I really need to listen to because I really have never heard the whole album. It doesn't help that it seems to be sort of banished from the face of the earth, but I'm sure that you can find it on YouTube. But no, I mean, the late 70s albums, we never found difficult to get into, you know?
I think Adult Child was our gateway into liking a lot of those records. I don't know why,
Adult Child is still, we're still talking about Love You. We're still talking about Brian's a Genius.
Yeah.
I know. I'm just talking about what opened us up to liking those records a lot. I mean, M.I.U., I remember, I love that record.
Well, probably My Diane, the fact that My Diane was such a amazing song, you know, like Match Point of Our Love, you know, that's a great lead. He is very involved in those albums, and those tend to be our favorite songs. Song.
Yeah, and there's a lot of great Carl vocals that happen over those years and stuff, and you know, it's worth listening for.
It is definitely more like we've gone through periods of listening to the whole album, but I think the songs that there are usually on those late 70s albums, like three or four songs that we always go back to, rather than fully loving the album the way we love Wild Honey.
Well, it's interesting. On your new record, especially a song like Peppermint Roses, there is an unabashed embracing of an innocence that a songwriter like Brian Wilson can unironically do. And it feels like, in a sense, that's like almost a new thing for you guys. It's like, fuck it, let's just dive headfirst into a pre-permissiveness period thing where it's like that was the style of relating in a song.
I feel like it's something that's a little bit missing in pop music. I don't know. There's almost like a false heaviness that's added to like almost every song you hear that comes out now, even if it's like a fast song.
Yeah, well, I think on the last record, like we have a song called Every Day is the Worst Day of My Life, which is so far into the point of being a downer that it's just funny, that it's almost like making fun of a song that's depressing. You know what I mean?
But you guys mean every word of it. I could tell. I can feel it.
You know, everybody feels like that. I think it's interesting to have the line repeat over and over and over again, because that's kind of the point. Every day is the worst day of my life, and that's all you feel like. But then I think you say it enough times and it is funny, but like, it's like, you know, you can only sit there and be miserable for so long before you just think it's funny or something. I don't know. So, but when it comes to the lyrics that are more, I guess, innocent or just fun, like Peppermint Roses, for me, it's more of like just painting with words type thing. And I like the way that these words sound and the images that they bring to mind. And I don't need to have it be so
personal.
Yes. And there's a bit of a story there, but it's more of a feeling than a story. And then in the choruses and the words that we're choosing are more important. And they kind of just bring to mind a psychedelic world.
We liked making this album a little bit more absurd, you know, and that has to do with like where you feel like you're coming from musically first. And then you try to put words that fit that.
Yeah, they reflect those feelings.
You know, it's interesting from, you know, the perspective of trying to create that innocence. Sometimes when you've stepped over the line and have experienced too much where you have to actually manufacture an innocence, I look at something like Can't Wait Too Long, which is an outtake from Wild Honey. And I probably like that more than any song on Wild Honey. But I understand also there's that thing of the riff that Brian falls into and gets hypnotized by, the feels that he creates, and the band being, I don't know whose idea it was to keep it off the record, but I could listen to a 3-hour version of that and not get sick of it. And
yeah, it is officially like unfinished, right?
I don't know.
But that's the kind of thing that I guess is like the most difficult to complete in a song with clear beginning, middle, and end. But I totally agree with you.
I love that song. I mean, sure, the lyrics are kind of nothing lyrics. I think that's kind of the point. But musically, it's just a pool that gets deeper and deeper and deeper the longer you listen to it. All right, that about does it. Stay tuned, because this upcoming week, we're back with our Michelle Phillips series as we enter the solo years.
This Monday, things kick off with Denny Doherty, which will be exclusively for our major tier Patreon members. And then on Wednesday, it's the director's cut of our Mama Cast Solo Years episode, featuring 18 minutes of essential bonus material. And then all you hoi polloi get the free version of Mama Cast the Solo Years. A heartfelt discography thanks goes out to my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, Brian and Michael Daddario, Ailey Orzak and Surefire Media, Captured Tracks, Rudy Fishman, Becky Boyd, my incredibly loyal fans, and especially the entire Patreon community, the Soldiers of Sound. I love every last one of you, and this show would not exist without you, my friends. Speaking of friends, it's high time for some new ones. They're in our Facebook group, Discography Soldiers of Sound. That's the best way to find out what's coming up on the show, but there's a hell of a lot more. You get recaps of the day in music history, the ability to pitch questions to guests, polls that put you in the driver's seat on guest and band decisions, and access to a thriving creative hub if you're looking for a collaborator. So make sure you don't miss out. You can find the link to the Discography Soldiers of Sound Facebook page right there in the show notes. And if you don't mess with the Zuck, no sweat. Just email me at info@discography.com and I'll keep you in the loop. So now that it's done and you want more, another way to dive even deeper into the greatest music ever made from the 1960s is to leap headfirst into my 12-hour interview with Jules Alexander and Terry Kirkman, the two founding members of Monterey Pop opening act The Association, that's episodes 110 to 113, Vashti Bunyan rating her entire catalog, that's 103 and 104, Os Mutantes Sergio Diaz on the early days of the band, that's 86 and 87, Burt Summer, 83 and 84, a tribute to David Crosby, that's 77 and 78, Lou Barlow rates the Zombies, that's 59 and 60, Bob Forrest on the band, that's 25 and 27, Monkees manager Andrew Sandoval rating the Monkees, that's 22 and 23, The Bee Gees' Psychedelic Beginnings, that's episode 10, and Sly and the Family Stone, episodes 5, 6, and 7. And of course, be sure to mark your calendars, because next Friday, May 24th, we're coming at you with Mama Cast the Solo Years. Trust me, you're not going to want to miss it. And so, from now till then, don't let our youth go to waste, lads and ladies. It's Discography!
Osiris.